Some scholars say that at least 80% of the Christians in the last half of the first century, going into the second century, became Gnostics. The great heresy ejected from the church as the church turned the corner, came out of the tunnel with strong bishops and established churches in the second century. And as the warfare of the church moved from the battle between faith and law to the battle with the Gnostics, something happened that produced the church of the second century with its fixed bishops, priests and deacons, a strong hierarchy, an apostles' creed, and set the stage for the church councils of the third and fourth centuries, where right doctrine takes over, with law already fixed. And we're still wrestling in the muddy waters and the swirl between the close of the New Testament and the fixed church establishment where most church history takes off. How did we get there? Now, we've struggled through the swirl and the murky water. By the best sources, we know that the church of Jerusalem was dominated by the natural or by marriage relatives of Christ. We know that Alexandria has a strong monastic quality to it, founded by Mark with the best traditions. They got his gospel and perhaps some other writings, and strong philosophers and aesthetic monastics begin to dominate the church there. We left Antioch with a compromise, and I got to get back to Antioch, and we will see the way the church literally distorts the history of Rome. And I was about to get into Mike covered it up. I was about to say he's to blame. The evidence suggests that the Apostle James came to Spain shortly after the ascension of our Lord. Now, what is the evidence that James was in Spain? And that's what I'm asking you. Are you interested in? And if you are, you get on a telephone and you tell me. Mission of James the Less to Spain is much attested in church history, yet not a single traditional church history book that I've ever read references it. They leave that 10 to 14 years, I believe 10, silent years of James. They don't even reference it. As they don't reference Paul's mission to Spain or Britain. Now, why was Paul going to Spain? Just as there were converts in Rome, before he got there, he was going to visit Spain because there was a flourishing church in Spain. Who founded it? And why? Now, you're starting to feel the gestalt of the teaching, if you'll think about it. I deliberately handle Valentinus the way I handled him because when I get into the heresy of Gnosticism and the response of the early church fathers to the threat of Gnosticism, you will be amazed at the powerful influence that Valentinus had. Now, as I read it in such a way designed to get the reaction. How in the world could anybody get turned on to that stuff? Well, now maybe you'll understand a statement by Paul about people at Corinth getting bogged down in vain genealogies. That wasn't Mormon-type genealogies. It was this kind of genealogies. The genealogies of the eons, the genealogies of the Gnostic philosophers, the genealogies of how the ultimate unknowable God of all gods, transitioned himself to that ridiculous concept from the Grecian frame and the blasphemous concept from the Jewish frame of God striking a tent in human flesh and moving in. Now, John states it simply, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God. Our King James confuses what's said in the Greek. The definite articles are very important in the Greek, like the opening of the Philippian letter where Paul says he gives thanks for them from the very first until the now. It's not proper in English. But the definite article in the Greek is a very precise instrument and is used in a different way than in the English. And the King James doesn't bring the full meaning of John 1 into its translation, because the literal is, in the beginning was the Logos. This, in Grecian philosophy, unknown mediator between the unknowable God and man that bridged that vast gulf. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with the God. And the Logos was God. Definite article deliberately left out. It doesn't say the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Neither does it say in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and the Word was the God. It doesn't say that. The literal is, the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and the Word was God, but not the God. Now, you can see how debates can take off on that. As far as I'm concerned, the sophisticated philosophic concept of God as unknowable silence, who has an ability to germinate like cells who divide, sexless but can reproduce himself like self, produces a dyad, truth and father, and these move on down through regimes of eons till you finally come to how Christ fits into this hierarchy of genealogy of gods and strikes that contact point between man and this origin of all things. No more difficult, no more philosophically dry than the Christian arguments of a first cause as a basis for believing in God. I don't need a first cause. If I don't believe in God for some other reason, I'd just soon have infinite regression. It doesn't bother me. But I'm going to tell you, these complicated borrowings from Grecian and Gnostic philosophy to describe an emanation from ultimate reality, the origin of all things, down through the series to a meaningful encounter with man, is easier to follow philosophically than this concept of the Trinity. I mean, the Trinity is just logically impossible to comprehend. But you will begin to understand why they were wrestling with the concept of the Trinity. Standing between monotheism, the Judaistic achievement in concepts of God, there's one God and only one, and polytheism with all of its gods and one to an unknown God in case they miss one, and the emanation theories of Gnosticism, these early church fathers had to come up with a creedal concept that embraced the revelation of Christ and retained the revelation of the Old Testament. Now, I've been kind of hard on them, but they had some hard problems. And before you say, oh, my God of mercy, eons and dyads and tetrads and heptads and some of them that sound like prescriptions from the corner druggist, and demiurges, I want you to understand that 80% of first century Christianity got bogged down in Gnosticism. And maybe for the first time, some of you will understand the warning of Paul not to get bogged down in vain genealogies. Just accept the revelation of Christ in its simplicity. God, whomever he may be, quit trying to go through that glass we see through darkly and trying with human finite wisdom to track from Christ to the God eternal and the relationships beyond that glass. Start with the verification, the vindication that God was in Christ reconciling the world because of the resurrection, and start with Christ where you meet him. And leave some of that stuff alone. Don't bog down in vain genealogies. Leave that part of your brain disconnected long enough to start finding the promises of God and act in faith, and God's Spirit will save you. You look at me like you don't understand why I'm even talking about this subject. I'm telling you, you're going to find Valentinus a powerful force, in spite of the fact that you didn't find him too attractive for yourself. Well, my friends, first time they served escargot to me in Tahiti, I thought anybody eat that stuff was crazy. Some tastes are cultivated, including philosophic tastes as well as scotch. Those that have eyes to see have seen. Those that have ears to hear have heard. Now give me some music and get on the telephone. If you want me to continue on this, I will. We're studying church history. Now, the part that is usually left out is the best part. Now, I have studiously avoided spending too much time with another record of church history that the traditional record totally leaves out. Remember, they didn't have TV and satellite in the first four centuries of the church. They didn't have the nightly news that could tell us when Jim Baker and Tammy got a doghouse that was air-conditioned. And that news would go around the world. None of that. And when the church councils begin to take shape and the Roman emperor Christianized the empire and made it the national faith, Rome, Alexandria, Caesarea, Jerusalem, Antioch, and Constantinople as the new capital dominate. Now, it is never, ever pointed out that in the earliest church councils, seating was a indication of preeminence. The earliest founded churches, because of the belief in tracing back to apostolic succession, the earliest founded churches got the preeminent seats. In all the early councils, Britain got the preeminent seats. And why was Paul going to Spain? Who founded the church in Spain? And if there was in the plan of God a mission to go to the lost tribes, why Spain? Now you're going to begin to find out that all this various teaching we've been doing eventually is going to fall together in one big harmony. I was reading from the book Dedicated Disciples by Henry W. Stow. I just like to jump around because there are just lots of sources for this. Here's another little known book, The Coming of the Saints by J.W. Taylor. It will be noticed on reading the earlier chapters of the Acts of the Apostles that there is an almost unaccountable absence of the name of St. James from the company of his fellow apostles, St. Peter and St. John. We read nothing of him until the brief account of his martyrdom when Herod the king killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. This is said to have taken place in A.D. 44. This writer agrees with the dating that I have, 10 years. You can sit down. Where was St. James and what was he doing during the 10 preceding years of unrecorded labor? St. James waited in Jerusalem as he had been directed until the first day of Pentecost. And from this day, the first day of Pentecost, until that of his death, any notice of his life is wanting from the records of the Bible. St. Peter and St. John were together at Jerusalem during the years immediately following, but nowhere do we read of the presence of St. James with them. This is remarkable, because he had been constantly with them before this, sole sharer with them of the special revelation on the Mount of Transfiguration, sole sharer with them again of the final conversation in the Garden of Gethsemane. His absence from their company afterwards, and especially when Peter and John went up together into the temple at the hour of prayer in Acts 3:1, following the day of Pentecost, needs some explanation. Where did James go? The only possible conclusion is that their constant companion in the older days must have been absent from Jerusalem. Well, I figured that out. Now there are some very old traditions reaching back to the earliest centuries which, if accepted, thoroughly explain this phenomenal silence regarding one of the chief of the apostles. In these, James is represented as St. James is represented as a distant traveler in the West. You see, you were wrong. In the very earliest years after Christ, and as a missionary pioneer in Sardinia and Spain, These traditions about St. James are so old and so definite. This writer says that I make no apology for reproducing their more prominent features. They represent the apostle as coming from the East and preaching the gospel both in Sardinia and in Spain, and then returning to Jerusalem for the keeping of the Passover festival or Easter at Jerusalem, and is suffering martyrdom during this visit to the church and to his friends in Palestine. His body is reputed to have been taken care of and brought from Palestine to Spain by loving disciples who buried him in Spanish ground among the people to whom he had first preached the gospel of the kingdom. A fact mentioned by contemporaneous historians, both Tacitus and Josephus, makes this mission antecedently more probable than it appears to be at first sight. Now, we started out in Antioch many years ago. At Antioch, Matthew will compose his gospel. And the war between faith and law that began when Paul was there begins to tilt toward law. Now, we've come a long ways from Antioch to Spain, the 10 silent years of change. And Aristobulus, and Philip, and Paul in Spain and Britain, and Joseph of Arimathea, and his daughter Anna, whom had been joined in marriage with the High King of Siluria. And whose daughter was the mother of the line through about seven generations that produced King Arthur. That's another subject. You've got to get acquainted with all these people to understand what's going on in the Carolina takeover by the religious mafioso of today. Comprenez-vous? Now let me take some 70-league boots. The rulers, the foreign rulers of Egypt, were kicked out by the ruler of the pharaoh of Upper Egypt about 50 to 100 years before the birth of Moses, and the ruling class, the descendants of Zara, fled. Some of them settled in Spain, became the Milesians. Their kings conquered Ireland, the High Kings of Ireland. About that time, Jeremiah shows up with the daughter of Zedekiah and joins the Pharaohs and Zara line. Also with the stone on which the kings were crowned, Jacob's pillar. This goes from Ireland with Fergus to Scotland and then to England and sits there now underneath the coronation chair. The Silurian kings of England, had long been in touch with Joseph of Arimathea, and Anna had been given in marriage to one of them, ancestor of King Arthur. James takes the gospel to Spain, a part that we will pick up later. The Silurian household is converted. Caradoc's house becomes the house of the church at Rome. Linus, his son, is appointed the first bishop, and yet Eusebius says Linus, whom we mentioned as being in Rome, the first after Peter. Hey, I don't want that. The first after Peter to have been appointed to the episcopacy of the church in Rome. Now you're going to see something about this official church historian. The first after Peter to have been appointed to the episcopacy of the church in Rome. Why is he saying that? Because Peter wasn't the first bishop of Rome. Peter didn't appoint him at Rome. Paul did. And he was of the house of Caradoc, the Silurian kings transplanted during the reign of Claudius. And that household of the faith, to whom Paul sends greetings in Romans 16 and 2 Timothy 4, was the British church transplanted. And Linus was the son of the British king. As Constantine had his roots in the British church, why this sudden shelling off of the Western church and the rewriting of church history with the total absence of the work of God, the first church above ground ever to be built at Glastonbury by this official church historian? Now, some things were going on in Britain and in Spain and in the household of faith at Rome between 70 A.D. and 100 A.D., but by the time we get into the second century, you would think the Church of Jesus Christ was Antioch, Rome, Alexandria, and Constantinople. Well, not by the second century, by the fourth Constantinople. But by the second century, Caesarea, Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria, Rome. What about Spain, Britain? Why this tunnel? In order that the historians might write the church history. way that ignores Spain, ignores Britain. And where did the preaching of Paul go until Marcion, a heretic, rescued it at Rome in 140 A.D.? Now, do you really think Jerry the Fat represents Christianity as a whole? Do you think he is the proper spokesperson of what Christianity is in the world today? Do you think Jimmy the Swaggering Jerk is? Do you think Jimmy the Yellow is? But if history were videotapes and the archives of the communicative agency of today, Nightline, they would represent the church of the 20th century. History wouldn't even know about us. I won't go on Nightline. I don't like their line. We've been hoodwinked, folks. You starting to get the message?